So it's Proverbs chapter 20 and verses 2 to 8. A king's wrath strikes terror like the roar of a lion. Those who anger him forfeit their lives. It is to one's honor to avoid strife, but every fool is quick to quarrel. Sluggards do not plow in season. So at harvest time they look, but find nothing. The purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, but the one who has insight draws them out. Many claim to have unfailing love, but a faithful person who can find? The righteous lead blameless lives. Blessed are their children after them. When a king sits on his throne to judge, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. I don't know about you, but I think this is for all of us. I need help when I'm tempted, when I don't have the motivation to press on, or I'm tempted not to choose what's right, to take up my cross and follow Jesus. And Proverbs helps us to have the sort of the motivation, the understanding, the wisdom to live wisely in God's world. Proverbs is teaching us how we can be successful in life, but in its ultimate and fullest sense. What is the right and the best and the life-giving way to live? At the beginning of Proverbs, it tells us, the beginning of wisdom is to fear the Lord, to submit ourselves to the awesome God. In the world that he made and sustains and rules over, he showed us how to live. And so if we can live wisely in his world, this is a world of blessing and God's favour and eternal life as we fear him with joy as his children. Proverbs, to gain the strength and the wisdom and the motivation to live well in this world. And in the passage we're looking at today, I want to take the theme of the king. Do you see at the verse 2 and verse 8, so at either end of our passage, sort of bracketing it, it begins and ends with a king. Not just any king, this king is angry in verse 2. He is judging in verse 8. And the wise person realizes that the king is going to judge. Now, David preached a few weeks ago on Romans chapter 13. It's on the website, if anyone missed it, verses 1 to 7, which teaches that God has established the king or the ruler in our country, in all the nations of the world, to punish wrong and to reward good. The king, the ruler, the government, is described as an agent of God's wrath, and that we should honour and obey the ruler for God's sake. And the king is God's appointed ruler, and the king is meant to do what's right. And so as we follow the king or the government, we're then being encouraged and motivated to live in the right way. Now in Proverbs, the king we're called to follow is always presented as the one who's always right, who's always wise, not like our flawed governments. This wasn't necessarily the experience of the people of Israel who would have first read Proverbs. In the Old Testament, God anointed his king over his people Israel. You think of someone like Solomon, the sort of the main author of Proverbs. He was such a king, he asked God for wisdom above everything else. And yet, he was flawed. He turned away from God and didn't lead the people well. The Old Testament kings were God's representative and called to be even his son. But even great kings like Solomon were flawed, and most of the kings were even worse. The king presented in Proverbs is not just a good king, but he's supernaturally so. You see in verse 8, when a king sits on his throne to judge, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. There's no ordinary king can see all evil in his kingdom and winnow it out, filter it out, remove it. No, the king in Proverbs is always pointing to that perfect king, the eternal Son of God, who perfectly fulfills the role of king. And that, of course, is how Jesus describes himself in Matthew chapter 12 and verse 42. Talking about the people who weren't listening to him, he says, "The queen of the south will rise at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to listen to Solomon's wisdom, and now something greater than Solomon is here." Jesus is God's wise, perfect king. And so just as in the same way that human kings and governments think twice and live better, even more powerfully, knowing Jesus as our king will help us to live in the right way, to live out our faith. And I want to draw three things about the king from this passage. Sort of like pegs on a washing line, this passage, the way I think about it. There's sort of three pegs. There's two pegs on either end. Okay, we've got the king in verse 2 and the king in verse 8. The king who's judging. And then the peg in the middle in verse 5 is talking about the purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, but one who has insight draws them out. And of course, in one sense, it's talking about anyone who has insight. But I think in the amidst these other verses, and when we look at verse 8, the king who winnows out all evil with his eye, who is the one who truly has insight? Who ultimately is this person? It's the king. So I want to sort of pick verses 2 and 5 and 8 for the three main headings, and we'll use the verses in between to show how we can apply this to ourselves, to find motivation and strength to live wisely for him. So we have verse 2, the king who is angry with evil. Verse 5, the king who sees evil. And verse 8, the king who removes evil. So firstly, verse 2, the king is angry with evil. Nowadays, you can watch a judge sentence a convicted criminal online. I watched one a few months ago where a judge passed a life sentence on a convict and said that he must serve more than 30 years in jail. It was one of these carefully balanced legal statements, and in a way all the more fearful when the judge precisely described the crime and the effects on the victims, the character of the offender. I mean, it was a terrible description. And then the consequences for him. It would be terrifying to think of yourself in that dock, contemplating your future as the judge says you may take the prisoner down. In Matthew 18, Jesus talks about him being present when the church meets to discipline a member who has sinned. A fearful moment where his judgment is expressed. He says, "Where two or three gather in my name, there am I with them." It's a somber and chastening moment to have the judge with us. And we see in verse 2 of our passage, when the king is angered, he strikes terror. Sometimes we struggle to understand Jesus in this way. We underestimate his perfection. We see people who are angry and how unpleasant they are, and we think Jesus must be just like them, selfish, hating people without cause, unfair. But no, Jesus brings perfect justice. Proverbs 8, and verse 13. In that passage, it speaks about how kings reign by wisdom, and says that wisdom hates pride and arrogance, evil behaviour and perverse speech. You see, we underestimate the seriousness of our sin. We think the anger of Jesus is too harsh because we don't see how he hates pride and arrogance and evil behaviour and perverse speech, the things in our own hearts. We recoil when we see the anger of Jesus because we find it so hard to bring ourselves to face what Jesus said in the passage we read in Matthew 13. The blazing fire where there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We don't want to cast our minds to the terrors of hell. And just like the wise person in this country wants to avoid being in the dock, we are wise if we contemplate and avoid the judgment of Christ. It's a judgment of terror, like the roar of a lion in verse 2. Now we're to live in a way that fears the Lord. After all, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But we need to live in a way that his judgment does not hold any terror for us. Imagine you're in a car in a safari park. I think you have a healthy fear of the lions. You're not going to open the door and leap out and stroke them. But you don't have a terror of them. You're safe inside your car. As we see the terror of Jesus' wrath here, just like recognizing the awesome killing power of a lion, and yet we make sure that we will stay safe. It's foolish to anger this king, and rather we should live wisely. Verses 3 and 4 give us two different examples of the kind of foolishness. In both cases, sort of avoiding some of our natural instincts. Verse 3, avoiding strife. And verse 4, making sure that we're not sluggards. Because any king needs his kingdom to be avoiding strife and to be productive. Of course, a king who has strife in his kingdom is in trouble. Just look at someone like Vladimir Putin. A kingdom that's unproductive won't be able to feed and sustain its people and the king. What, of course, does our boss or our teacher want? Everyone in the class or in the workplace fighting? What does a sports coach want? Everyone putting in the minimum possible effort? What does our government want? Sort of low economic growth? And so Jesus the king, what does he want? He doesn't want the strife and the laziness that angers him. And so we look at these verses 3 and 4 to see how we can live with honour and fruitfulness before our king. And in verse 3, it says, it's to one's honour to avoid strife. I think that's quite a startling statement, that honour comes from avoiding strife. Because when we get into disagreements and arguments and fighting, the thing we're striving for very often is honour itself. Strife comes when we're trying to defend our honour, when we spot every little insult and tease it out, every time that we're overlooked, that our effort has not been rewarded, that our character has been impugned, maligned, our preferences have been sidelined. We want to defend our honour. And this is quite the change of mindset. Because it doesn't always seem life is to gain honour. People might think that we're weak if we don't defend ourselves. But this is the real honour to avoid strife. This is what is honourable in the sight of the king. And by contrast, every fool is quick to quarrel. It's the default, the knee-jerk reaction. So what do we do when someone treats us badly? How do we respond? Do we need to defend our honour at all costs? Or can we think of how to respond in a way that doesn't make it worse? Maybe I need to take a hit to my honour in the eyes of the other person and so gain greater honour with the king. Let's think and talk and pray about how we can respond without creating conflict. Don't add strife to our friends. Maybe sometimes we respond thoughtlessly or just to show off or gain the best position. How do we really gain honour and the best place in our friendship group? By avoiding strife? Maybe they'll recognise it, maybe they won't. But even if they don't, the king does. He knows what's best in his kingdom. And he is angry when we take apart God's creation, when we live in conflict and opposition and war and strife and quarrelling. From the quarrelling family to warring nations, life, doesn't it? We know what it's like to be in strife and the hurt that that causes. And God cares about that. When God is denied, when strife is built up, it's God and his perfect plan that's denied and insulted and offended. The honour comes not from the person who's building up strife. The honour in this world comes from God. And so we can be encouraged when we've been walking in the way of deflecting strife, of losing some of our honour in the world. Because Jesus sees and he commends that. It's not that we can never defend ourselves. But as far as it depends on you, Romans 12 verse 18, live at peace with everyone. Is there a way that we can get extra honour this week by avoiding strife and not being quick to quarrel? So it's to our honour to avoid strife. And blessing comes from work, not from laziness, in verse 4. The sluggard thinks that they can be blessed by enjoying the relaxation of not doing anything rather than the fruit of their hard work. Sluggards do not plough in season, so at harvest time they look but find nothing. Now, ploughing is really important to get plants to grow. And you can imagine this sluggard here looking around and all his neighbours back-breaking work. They're digging the fields, or maybe they've got the hard and heavy and monotonous job of leading their oxen backwards and forwards, pulling a plough to break up the ground. And here's this sluggard sat back in his recliner, I don't know, sort of chuckling away. Then when it comes to harvest time, it's almost as if he's got a complete surprise. He comes to harvest, walks out into his field, you know, maybe he's walked past his neighbour's field, all the stuff's growing, they're ready to harvest, comes to his own field, oh, there's nothing there. Expect to get something, but find nothing. He's not had to work all winter, life's been easy. And that's the sort of one of the inclinations of our hearts, isn't it? That we want to get on without work. Don't we wish we could pass exams without revising or provide for our families without having to go to work? Or, you know, sometimes our hearts, we want to grow as a Christian but without prayer. We want to see people around us all helped but without actually helping them. This life without work is a dream for many people in our society. The ultimate dream is to retire with plenty. Let's not make that our dream, but rather to be fruitful for the king. The focus isn't on great achievements. This sluggard, all he needed to do was grow some food in his field. The focus for us is to work for Jesus. He is in advance for us to do. So when it's hard to be motivated, let's look to the King, realise that we're serving him. Because if we set ourselves on a course of life that prioritises gaining leisure for ourselves and not serving God, Jesus is angry with that pattern of life. So we've seen the anger of the King. And then secondly, in verse 5, we see that Jesus the King sees evil. Verse 5, the purposes of a person's heart are deep waters, but one who has insight draws them out. Sometimes people look quite good from the outside, and we think they're peace-loving, they're productive, they're faithful towards others and towards God. Many people show different characteristics of wisdom, but when we come to look at people's hearts, they are not as single-minded and well-disposed as it might seem on the outside. Our hearts are deep waters. Deep waters are dark and unsettling. They're lifeless. They're something unknowable with an air of menace. Something that's potentially deadly. We think that we are, or that others are, that people are more faithful than they truly are. Have you seen the survey results where they ask people, how good are you at driving? And apparently, 80% of people in this particular survey I saw say that they are above average drivers. Our evaluation of ourselves is so different to the reality. It's not just that we can't understand all of a person's heart, their deep waters. But verse 6 goes further. Many claim to have unfailing love, but a faithful person, who can find? I guess if we did the same survey, you know, who thinks they're a good person? Most people would say they're above average. We really find a perfect person. And being wise is to have insight into the heart, to draw out something of people's motives and character, to understand that we are mixed motives, that our hearts are not pointing all in the right direction. And there's only one person, though, who can see right through to our hearts with a single look, the King Jesus. In verse 8, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. He is the one who has insight to draw out what's in our hearts. Remember the rich young man who came to Jesus? He said, I keep all the commandments. And Jesus said to him, sell everything you have and follow me. The man went away sad, and Jesus knew that this outward display of faithfulness was hiding his love of money above God. And so we see the glory of our King, Jesus, who is God and man. No ordinary human can see into our hearts. With all their technology, the government can't see into our hearts. But here is a King, the man Jesus, who looks into these deep waters and sees right through us with absolute clarity. From the outside, we can put on a good show. We can show love and commitment and purity and selfishness and laziness and lust. Who can really find a faithful person who shows unfailing love? You see, we can't trust anyone, can you? You get someone to do some work for you. You take references beforehand. Why do you do that? We can't trust people from the outside. When we want someone to look after our children, we have safeguarding procedures in place because we can't trust people. Even when we try ourselves, we let other people down. We are let down by our family, by our boss, by our neighbours, and we let them down too. Jesus also saw into someone else's heart in John 1:47. He saw Nathanael approaching and he said of him, "Here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." He wasn't perfect, of course, but he was honest. And we need to be honest about the deep waters of our heart. Not to claim unfailing love, not to put on a show, because the King can see right through us. But to stand before the King openly and confess who we really are. Because when God sees into our heart, when Jesus sees into our heart, it is actually a positive and a life-giving thing. Do you remember the woman at the well in Samaria in John 4? Jesus saw straight into her heart. He said, "Bring your husband." And she said, "Oh, I haven't actually got a husband." He said, "Yes, you've got five husbands, and the person you're living with is another man who isn't your husband." He saw straight into her heart. Now, you remember the rich man went away sad. She didn't go away sad when Jesus looked into her heart. She went back to the others in the town. "Come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done." You see, when we open our hearts to Jesus, when we don't cover up, when we don't claim an unfailing love that we don't actually have, he doesn't react, but with compassion and salvation and a change of life. Jesus, the King, is angry with evil. Jesus, the King, sees our evil. And thirdly, Jesus, the King, will remove our evil in verse 8. When a king sits on his throne to judge, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. The king's eyes is not just to see the evil, but to winnow it out. Now, winnowing is the process of separating the good grain from the chaff. So you think they throw it up in the air and the breeze kind of blows away the lighter bits that aren't good for eating. And then the heavier bits, the grain that you would eat, collects together on the floor. And that's what Jesus does with evil. He sorts it. He purifies it. And so when Jesus sits on his throne and sees into our hearts, he winnows out all evil with his eyes. We read from Matthew 13 earlier, and the parable of the weeds. And there we saw that the wicked and the righteous grow together, and Jesus is going to send his angels to gather out of this kingdom everything that causes sin and all that do evil, and will throw them into the blazing furnace where there will be weeping and gnashing of the teeth. And this leaves the righteous. The righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. This is our great hope, that all evil will be removed. We can barely imagine a world where we don't have to work really hard to make sure that we can trust someone. Imagine a world where you can find a faithful person everywhere. What about a world where there's no strife, no bullying, no selfishness? What about a world where everyone pulls their weight? There's no laziness, there's no buck passing. What about a world where we're free from that sin ourselves? Jesus is going to winnow evil, to remove evil so there's only goodness left. You see, when you read verses 5 and 6, it can almost be a counsel of despair. In verse 5, people's hearts are concealing a darkness. In verse 6, everyone's saying they're really good, but they're not. But just before we're tempted to despair, we have this wonderful verse in verse 7. The righteous lead blameless lives. Blessed are their children after them. You see, the lives of the righteous stand out in a world of darkness and hypocrisy. When faithfulness seems so rare, and people put themselves first, when so few people honour God and serve him, the righteous stand out. They live blameless lives. They're blameless in front of others, before God, before the King. They don't anger the King. Their life doesn't hang in the balance. They're not terrified by the roar of the lion, by the anger of Jesus. They don't try to avoid his perceptive eye or cover up. They please the King and they approach him with confidence. This is how Job was described. A man who was blameless and upright, he feared God and shunned evil. Now, don't misunderstand this. Our status before God isn't based on our own perfection, on being completely without sin. If you just drop down to verse 9, just after the passage we've read, you will say, I have kept my heart pure, I am clean and without sin. Who can claim to have perfect, unfailing love? Who can claim that their heart is perfect? But in Philippians, Paul describes himself as not having a righteousness of his own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ. But there's blamelessness in the way that we're called to live. So in that same book in Philippians, where the righteousness comes not from ourselves, but from Christ, in Philippians 2 and verse 12, he says, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it's God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose. Do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure. Children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky. You see, the salvation of Jesus is powerful. It changes us. If you're a Christian, then your heart's desire is to live in a way that is blameless and righteous and fulfills his good purpose. If you have that desire, it's the work of the Holy Spirit in your life. And this is a beautiful image of life against the backdrop of the terrible judgment against hypocritical hearts. And this is the kind of life that has a powerful impact on those who observe it. Look at the second half of verse 7. Blessed are their children after them. Children see the way of life of their parents up close. They see their blameless way of life and they are blessed. If you have children, how are you going to bless them? By living in obedience to God. It really puts everything in perspective. Earning money, holidays, nice house, toys, even a good education. What is the thing that most blesses our children? To see the goodness of life lived for God. That was my experience as a child. What was important to my parents made a big impact on me. Their commitment to God's people, the importance of the scriptures and worship and prayer and preaching, the importance of popularity or money or ease. They showed us discipline and mercy. I didn't like missing a birthday party in order to go to church, but that was exactly consistent with their way of life. They sacrificed for God and showed me that that's not really a sacrifice or a cost at all. Now, it's not that my parents were without fault, as we all know. We could all, when we do, sit round the dinner table as a family, with them and the rest of the family, listing each other's faults. But they chose to live for Christ. So if you have children, or one day might do, will you put your righteousness first? Because that's what they need. Many of you in this room have that blessing of children who are of parents who are living for Christ. Are you going to follow them and live a righteous life and therefore fulfill and continue this blessing? Now, many of us don't have children, and some of us have been really let down, where that outward unfailing love that's been claimed hasn't matched up to how we've been treated. For some, verse 6 is a really painful reality. Many claim to have unfailing love, but a faithful person, who can find? But Jesus is removing from this world and will remove evil, and he is establishing righteousness. So how are we going to live? If we trust Jesus, we're not in terror of the king, but we have a reverent fear of the one whose judgment is like a lion. We're not going to put on a good show for him because he can see right into our hearts. So confessing our sin, and as he gives us strength, we commit ourselves to living righteous lives, obedient to him. And it blesses our children, it blesses the world. Let's take a bit of time to reflect. Maybe the terror of Jesus has struck you this morning. We can confess and repent so that we are not the evil that he is removing. Maybe you've been challenged about conflict or laziness or honesty about your heart. Maybe you just want to spend a few moments asking Jesus for his strength that you can live righteously with him. Let's take a few moments.